This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. England get it launched. A tepid first hour turns on its head when Gareth Boyes goes slightly more direct. And then Henderson, Kane and Saka make it all look pretty easy. In the middle of it all, Jude Bellingham, who is 19 years old. And Jordan Henderson, just a little bit more than a good talker. Senegal were good for a little bit, then did absolutely nothing as once again the favourites progressed. You'd imagine Kylian Mbappe was terrified watching that after he barely turned up against Poland, or more accurately, scored two utterly brilliant goals. He shouldn't get all the headlines after all. Olivier Giroud is now the all-time top scorer for his nation. Again, the polls were okay for a bit, but so far no upsets in the last 16. Also today, a little look ahead to Monday's games. We mourn losing Arsene Wenger to the FIFA machine, ask why the camera has to keep panning to Gianni Infantino, and pull back the curtain just slightly into how we make this nonsense. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair. Bonjour, ça va?
Bonsoir, mon vieux.
From the Racing Post, Mark Langdon, hello.
Hi, Max.
Ashley says, how much is Barry selling his bottled tears for? Marco says, run, Barry, pull a sickie. Barry, you even tried to get out of watching most of this game, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a power cut during the second half, which threw me into a bit of a panic. So I haven't seen the third goal, and I missed the 5 minutes either side of it. So don't ask me anything about those. I actually thought I was going to have to record this in the pub, which, you know, wouldn't have been terrible for me, but probably wouldn't be great for the listeners.
I can just imagine you next to the, with a big pair of secateurs next to the power in England ahead of the World Cup final, just with a big grin on your face going, cut. Anyway, first of all, let's go to Barney Ronnie, who was there at the Al Bayt Stadium. Barney, how was that for you?
It was weird. I mean, it was probably like it was for most other people. We spent the first 25 minutes saying, oh dear, this isn't going very well. And I thought Senegal had a plan, a good plan, which was to, they tried to isolate, they pressed really well high up the pitch, tried to isolate Harry Maguire. You could see them really surging around and making him turn. And you thought about Kylian Mbappe in that moment and thought, well, okay, at least we didn't get that far and didn't have to deal with that. But luckily, Jude Bellingham exists, and he is brilliant. And he, again, as he did in the first game against Iran, he's such a sort of leader. Him and Henderson, I think the midfield three was really good. They're really balanced, almost sort of accidentally. England suddenly have, I think, as balanced a midfield as I've ever seen them have, really. It's very good. They've got a bit of everything in there. You've got Henderson as this kind of grown-up who can be horrible. And then you've got Rice sort of gliding around with his rangy stride, and we love a rangy stride. And then Bellingham, who can do anything, who's just brilliant. He's just such a good player. And it's their strength. I really hope they stick with it against France, because I want to see them test themselves, not hide in a kind of back seven again. Go out there. And I'm not normally a throw the handbrake off man, but I'm reaching down, I'm wrenching it off. I'm trying to get the handbrake off. I feel these leashes on me. I want them removed now.
You have to credit Southgate, right? He got it right. I totally agree with you. I would love him to keep that three. And if he goes to three at the back, he can't keep that three. And so he kind of, in many ways, his hand might be forced to just keep the handbrake off. The car is moving. You can't just lift the handbrake up unless you're one of the Blues Brothers. You'll spin around.
No, the handbrake's already gone. He's rolling down the hill towards a ravine. He's looking out the window. He's shouting. He's waving. But the car is just gone. Bellingham is driving the car. And it feels like England, this team, you thought they're in danger of aging England in the last year. You thought this team is getting stale. It's been 7 years. There's not really anything new in it. Sterling, Kane, Maguire, Stones and Pickford. I'm sure that was happening 5 years ago. But there is this new thing in there, this sort of strength, this mobility in midfield that I really haven't seen. It's kind of old-fashioned as well. I love the way he surges. He's got that Steven Gerrard surge. But it's a really clever kind of modern version of it, where you're also really tactically aware and careful, and you can do everything. You know, it's I don't mean to talk him up, but he's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. How was the atmosphere in there?
It was good, although there was, like, for about the first 10, 20 minutes, you thought, yeah, this Senegalese drumming is really good. I'm really enjoying this Senegalese drumming. And then after about an hour of the Senegalese drumming, which didn't really, there wasn't, like, maybe there were really subtle variations in pitch and tone and rhythm that I just couldn't pick up. They just kept going. But no, I mean, the atmosphere was good. There are quite a lot of English people here that come out for the latter stages. The atmosphere is weird, you know, like everything else here. It's kind of painted on, and the stadium is grotesque. You know, it's this lighted dome in the middle of the desert. That it's just an unhappy feeling place. Somehow in the middle of it, this thing happens on a square of green, which is good.
It's weird because there's been quite a lot of talk, moving away from the game for a second, but about actually how this World Cup is really wonderful. Like, people who've been there for a couple of weeks are now going, do you know what? I was wrong to be sceptical, and the whole thing is great. I see you, I mean, really scrunching your eyes up there, Barney.
Sometimes you realise, you get a glimpse of how sort of venally, sort of self-motivated, and sort of how sort of weak people are. I mean, I've been really disappointed by how easy it is to kind of wipe people's minds if you just show them a nice. I've been in my hotel for a week, and it seems nice, and the people I've met seem happy. And inside this lighted dome, where everyone's wearing accreditation, I saw a man in a stars and stripes suit, hugging a man in traditional Arab dress. And I'm just calling it like it is. That's what I saw with my own eyes. So, I mean, that's not journalism. That's just seeing what you've been presented with and responding to it without interpreting it. I literally heard a BBC pundit say that, someone who I previously respected on a BBC podcast, and thought, this is just asinine. Like, you've melted. You're like the people at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark staring into the light, you know. Cling to the tree, Indy. Don't look. Because you need to show more judgment than that and not simply be gawping into the light because it's been a good World Cup, which it has, because football is good.
Changing tack again slightly, Chesney Hawks, I believe, did halftime again. And Barney Ronay versus Chesney Hawks was the Twitter beef that I was really expecting during this tournament.
It wasn't really a beef. I really like Chesney Hawks. Is such a nice man. Clearly, he sent me a nice tweet, and I tried to respond with what I thought was an amusingly cutting line, but kind of probably came out slightly too mean. Well, I suggested that he perform one of his other hits.
Yeah, I thought that was really, I thought that was very Route One, Barney. I thought it was like, you know, Hawks will have heard that before, and I wasn't expecting, I thought you'd scythed him down there, basically.
No, I mean, Hawks can handle it. Hawks can look after himself. Don't worry about that. He may have a babyish, lovely blonde hair, lovely babyish face, but, you know, it's a tough business, and Hawks can handle himself. But he came back with just the nicest response. He alphaed me with kindness, and so I thought, oh, you really are a nice person. I think Hadley Freeman interviewed him and said he was literally almost like overwhelmingly nice and charming, and I felt it too. I felt the Chesney power.
Barney, thank you, mate.
Thanks, bye.
Barney Ronay there. So, Mark, that was all very straightforward. By the 79th minute of that game, I was tweeting about the depth of the goal nets at Zaragoza. This is not how watching knockout games for England normally goes.
No, there was sort of very little jeopardy, really. As soon as Harry Kane made it 2-0 just before half-time, that seemed to end the tie almost at that moment. And we maybe shouldn't be so blasé about that when you see Argentina being made to work until, you know, the 90-odd minute against Australia, and there have been many other upsets during this World Cup. You know, to end the game 3-0, and it wasn't all perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, to win a last 16 game by 3-0, no injuries, everybody looks fit, you know, the Gareth Southgate team choices, the debatable ones, all made an impact. And, you know, there's a lot of positivity that should be taken forward to what is a very difficult and a much different test in the quarterfinal that's coming up.
We've got to give credit to Gareth Southgate, haven't we, Philippe? I mean, he ignored the noise that he never really listens to and the clamour for whoever should play or not, and he went with his own thoughts and he got it spot on.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the big call was probably Saka instead of Rashford. So I think Phil Foden probably had nailed his place in the starting lineup. Bellingham had to be in there, and heavens, oh, thank heavens he was there, because what a beautiful thing it is to see Jude Bellingham on a football pitch. Even Barry would agree with that. I can see him grinning in the background. Oh, it yeah. is, Barry. Come on. I know, admit it. Admit to it.
Oh, no, he was brilliant. And he seems like a really, really nice, very mature young man. I mean, I remember when I was 19, I was a complete dickhead. Some many would argue with some justification.
Yes, I mean, it's an open goal. Yes.
That I still am. But he just seems great. He's a lovely, lovely bloke.
Well, no, and a wonderful footballer. Now, the question that I have is that, because to be honest, I'm really, it's really strange. It's like there was no game tonight. England took the lead somehow against the run of play, mm-hmm. a little bit. And then afterwards, it was very much Senegal didn't really exist, really. So I've rarely felt that. Normally, when you watch England in this kind of games, you feel a little bit either frightened or hopeful, depending on which side of the fence you decide to sit on. This was not the case. You knew it was going to happen. So he got the right choice. He got the choices, obviously, right for this particular game. I'm wondering, is he going to stick with this kind of team against the French? Because one of the questions we had before the game was that, is he going to go for three at the back, which he has tended to do in every time, actually. In fact, England has faced some really serious opponents in a tournament. Or is he going to stick with four? And he stuck with four, and it worked. So what is he going to do? So we're already projecting ourselves onto the French game, which we might have a chat about, you know, in the next few days. But we should forget that up until Henderson opened the scoring, it wasn't quite as fluid and beautiful as people might think it was. It was not. It was actually pretty... No. It was pretty workmanlike and uninspired and leaden and so forth. But afterwards, you know, again, it's a team. And it's a question I'm throwing to you. I think it lacks definition. I still don't know what that team is like. I don't know.
Simon says, is watching Jude Bellingham, that's an interesting Bellingham question, is watching Jude Bellingham like it was watching Gazza in Italia 90? And I thought it's different because Bellingham, I think, if he stays fit, will have a much better career, probably, than Gazza. But Gazza had something completely different about him as a footballer. And I think Bellingham is such an incredible talent. I don't know, maybe it's just I was younger and I didn't have anything, you know, I had no worries and no cares. But there was something about the way Gazza played football that it was like pure attacking. There was no sort of sensible hard work that Bellingham does. It was just all joy. I don't know if anyone agrees or disagrees with me on that.
It's an interesting question, and it's not something that had ever even crossed my mind until it was asked. Obviously, I don't see a huge amount of Jude Bellingham because I don't watch the Bundesliga, so my exposure to him is pretty limited to Champions League and internationals. Even just think the way they run is completely different. I'd be loath to say who's better, and obviously Bellingham is very young. Yeah, it's an interesting question, and one to which I do not have an answer.
No, evidently.
Yeah. Yes, sorry.
I think with Gazza there was, you know, this doubt about whether he would start, wasn't there? You know, there were more senior players potentially ahead of him at Italia 90. And even though I think he would have been older than Bellingham, he kind of had that daftness that sort of made him feel like he was about 16. And Bellingham, on the other hand, is a 19-year-old playing as if he's 27 and like actually one of the leaders of the team. You during the goal celebrations, he's kind of bossing people around and, you know, he's captain Borussia Dortmund. And I think he feels like a very different character to Gascoigne. So maybe it's hard to make the comparisons. Where I think the you could make that comparison is just in talent. I mean, Gazza was, until his injury, is very special. And Bellingham, you know, as long as he doesn't sort of go down the wrong path, I mean, he's going to become, I think, an England great. I mean, he's somebody that I've no idea how much he's going to cost when Borussia Dortmund sell him. But if you were trying to build like the perfect central midfielder, he'd have a lot of what you would be looking for. He's a special talent.
We should also talk about Jordan Henderson, Barry, because it's sort of, there is this sort of cliche, you know, when he was brought on, you know, social media was a meltdown against the US going, what are we bringing Henderson on there? You know, he's only good because he talks. But actually, like, he led the press in this game. He always wants the ball. He gives it sensibly. He gets beyond the midfielders like he does for Liverpool, right? He's always making that run for Liverpool, isn't he, in behind. And he was again a sort of, wasn't expected to be like a definite starter, but you feel he has to start against France.
I'd be surprised if he didn't start, but I don't think he has to. I don't understand his detractors, if I'm honest. I am slightly biased because, you know, he has that Sunderland link and Liverpool bought him from them for what was at the time considered a huge amount of money and a waste of money. And I mean, what an investment it turned out to be. And God, I wonder that sliding doors moment in his career where he could have gone to Fulham, but decided Liverpool wanted to sell him to Fulham, and he just put his foot down and said, I'm not going. Who knows what would have happened if he had. Yeah, he's a great leader on the pitch. And what's wrong with being a good talker? I mean, he can play football. There's no doubt about that. And I think he's an excellent leader, and he clearly has the respect of his teammates at Liverpool and for England. So, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree he has to start, but I think he probably will.
And Mark, there'd been some slightly ridiculous chat about Harry Kane, and, you know, he hadn't scored, and therefore if a centre-forward doesn't score, then there's no point in him in existing. And, like, he proved everything today, didn't he? Not only did he score, he was instrumental in that first goal. Like, the turn and the pass to Bellingham was absolutely perfect. And, you know, he's such a pivotal part of this team.
Drives me crazy when there are some fans that just want him to goal hang and, you know, be in the penalty box all the time. I mean, you'd be taking away so much of what makes him the player that he is. And by dropping deep, as long as the midfielders or the wide players are committed to making those runs that Barry was just talking about there with Henderson or, you know, Bellingham or the two wide players, you need that. But as you know, assuming that's part of the tactic, having Kane drop deep makes perfect sense. And he really toyed with Senegal, and that they had no answer to what he was doing to them. Fully deserved his goal. I couldn't understand anybody that wouldn't want Harry Kane in the team. We had this at the Euros when people were calling for Calvert-Lewin to start in place of Harry Kane. And now it's Callum Wilson. They're both, you know, they're both okay forwards. And if they need to come on, you know, hopefully they can do a job. But they're not at Harry Kane's level. And, you know, even if he's not scoring goals, he's contributing in many other ways. And, yeah, it's crazy to even sort of entertain that kind of debate.
We'll talk about France's win over Poland in just a second, Philippe. But Porrick says Mbappe's good. Should England play all their right backs against France to stop him? Sam says, how many yards head start will Maguire need against Mbappe? Should he set off now?
Yes.
I mean, he'll be on the other side of the pitch, hopefully. But I mean, that will be fascinating to see. Like you mentioned, do they play a three? You could play Walker on the right of the three and Trippier to stop him. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Walker v Mbappe is it's happened before. They've played against each other before, but it would be fascinating to see.
I would imagine it's going to be Walker, in terms of speed of recovery. And I would imagine that against France playing a 4-3-3, I would imagine that he's going to be very tempted to play three at the back, which, of course, is going to create a problem because who are you going to leave out? Because you're not going to leave out, Rice is going to be there. Yeah. He's the foundation.
That's it. You can't play Bellingham, Rice and Henderson if you play
exactly
at the back.
So who would you leave out?
Unless you play a 3-5-2 and play two up front. And they haven't ever done that, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's going to be fascinating for so many reasons. This is why I was saying that in a way with England, in some ways, we're still, there's a lack of definition. we know what France will look like. We absolutely have no doubt on what it's going to be like. Tchouaméni is going to be back at the holding midfielder. Rabiot will be there as a kind of in a free role, and Griezmann will be there, the kind of deep lying playmaker. And then you'll have, unless there are injuries, Mbappé, Griezmann, Mbappé, Giroud, and Dembélé. With England, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure. And the thing is that the dynamism we saw, certainly after the first goal, especially after the second goal, was also due to the fact that the way the England were set up. And we might not see that set up against France. We might not see this kind of expansive game that we saw in the second half against a Senegal team, which I have to say we've barely said anything about it.
I'm intrigued, you know, because they were decent in the first half hour. They had probably the three best chances in the opening half hour. There was that Kane cross to Saka, which he didn't throw himself at. They just gave up. And I don't understand the mentality. They just completely gave up when they went 2-0 down.
I think the absence of the two midfielders, you know, very important players, Idrissa Gueye and Koyate, that, you know, when things are going bad, I suppose you need somebody that's able to bring the team together. And Lucy Say on the sidelines was telling the team to calm down, wasn't he? But I think they just lost heart, really. To concede with the last kick of the half, probably they did give up after that moment. They actually had more shots than England, but most of them in the second half were pretty wild and untroubling for Pickford.
I mean, it's interesting. A fully fit Senegal team, like with those two not suspended not injured, and with Sadio Mane, it's a totally different football match, isn't it? We should just mention Raheem Sterling. Jacob Steinberg tweeting, has returned to the UK to check on his family after his house was broken into by armed robbers on Saturday night. He hopes to return to Qatar if the circumstances are right. You know, it's an increasing problem, that, isn't it? Footballers having their having their houses robbed, and worse, you know, like robbers coming into the home when they are away and their family are at home. So, like, we obviously wish him and his family all the best. On a slightly different note, Adam says, can there ever be referee wonder kids? The commentator just mentioned the referee of England Senegal is only 31, which seems remarkably young for a referee, doesn't it? Isn't sort of an age where eventually you just can't have the authority because you're so young? But yeah, 31 does seem young. Phil says, does anyone else see Roy Keane using one of those pens with four different colours in one? Yeah, it was when England scored the first, I think, and you saw Ian Wright cheering, and then Roy Keane turned around to Wright, presumably, who scored it. He says, does he go through the red a lot quicker than the other colours, surely? It's a very good point. I did enjoy this tweet from Michael Spicer, you know, who does the brilliant videos on social media of, you know, the PR guy or whatever, the comms guy in the room with pretending to be speaking into Boris Johnson's ear or whatever. He says, why is it when the camera focuses on World Cup fans, everyone is young and fabulous, but when they cut to England fans, there's always a, quote, man pleads guilty to mistreating pet snakes energy. Not entirely fair, but it was very funny.
Sorry, just on the subject of fans, the Senegal fans are something else.
Yeah, brilliant.
Just dance, drum, sing the whole way through. Even after the final whistle, they've been trashed and they're still giving it large. And they're just brilliant. I particularly love those guys who've painted themselves white and have got S-E-N-E-G-A-L. You know, just the manner in which they always manage to stand in the right formation, right order, and don't end up with an embarrassing misspelling.
So you were very against face paint the other day when I said I had had my face painted for the England-Tunisia game in France 98. Oh, and I had my face painted for England-Trinidad in 2006. That's almost a habit. So what's the difference? I mean, obviously, mine was less artistic. It does look better, but I accuse you of double standards, Barry.
Yeah, that's probably a fair enough accusation, Max. I'm guilty as charged.
Anyway, England France then is next Saturday night. So, you know, get your mulled wine ready to throw over your mates at Box Park for that. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll talk about France's pretty straightforward win over Poland. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly then. France 3, Poland 1. That was sort of quite straightforward in the end, Philippe. Poland, I guess, gave us more than we thought they might. But really, you know, I suppose what the story of the game is, Olivier Giroud becomes France's top goalscorer of all time. And Kylian Mbappe is actually gets all the plaudits and is the story.
And Hugo Lloris equals the number of caps. Highest number of caps, 142 for the French national team. And Antoine Griezmann establishes a new record of the number of games played consecutively for a national team, 71. That's not bad.
And Adrien Rabiot. And Adrien Rabiot has his fourth good game in a row.
Yeah. Actually, he had a decent game. We're not going to talk about it at all, but there you go. I don't know. I mean, all the talk is about Kylian Mbappe and not about Olivier Giroud, which I suppose is typical of both. Because in so many ways, Olivier Giroud was, you know, perhaps the most important player with Antoine Griezmann of that French national team today. Certainly his first goal is a thing of absolute beauty, of incredible intelligence in front of goal. And I would say as well that his first touch for Kylian Mbappe's first goal. Oh, what do you say about that?
Berbatov levels.
Yeah, I was going to say Santi Cazorla because of my affiliation. But it's like the ball, when it's coming down, it's got snow on top. It's like it's been so high. And then not only does he deaden the impact of the ball, but it deviates the path of the ball so that it's perfectly in the way so that he can send Dembele, who sends Kylian Mbappe to goal, and it was a thing of beauty. But it's absolutely typical that we should be talking about Kylian Mbappe, even though I'm talking about Olivier Giroud right now after that, because it's typical of what his career has been with the French national team, is that he's the most properly respected and non-respected and overrated, underrated player in the history of the game, I think. I think that's about it, isn't it? Everybody agrees that he's actually pretty damn good, and that in a way, how we say that he's pretty damn good is that we're saying, oh, he's not respected as he should be, even though everybody knows he's bloody good, and you don't get to 52 goals. I think Thierry Henry would be absolutely livid, by the way, to see.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I see Mark. We're on Zoom. I can see Mark's face here. And I can see Baz laughing his head off. I think they agree with me. I think Titi will be absolutely livid that it's somebody like Olivier Giroud who has actually beaten
There was always this rumour that Thierry Henry, when he went to Sky, he had a £500 coat hanger and that he got very upset when it was lost. And I judge a man who needs a coat hanger that costs £500. It may be apocryphal, so I don't know. So I'm judging for something that may not be true, but it seems like an expensive coat hanger. If the coat hanger is more expensive than any item of clothing I've ever worn, it's too expensive for a coat hanger.
I will make a confession here on the Guardian Football Weekly.
Oh, please do.
Special World Cup. Okay. I'm not somebody who steals things. I don't take, you know, pens away from the office, but on the day that Arsenal played their last game at Highbury, together with two fellow journalists whose name I will not give, we kind of got lost a little bit in the underbelly of Highbury, and we ended up in the dressing room, and there was Thierry Henry's coat hanger there.
Good.
It's there in my flat.
It's probably worth a small fortune. Take it to Antiques Roadshow for insurance purposes.
I nicked it. Thierry, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No wonder he was annoyed. There's form of having his coat hangers stolen.
It was No, wait a minute. It was the absolute box standard Arsenal plastic red coat hanger, but it was Thierry Henry's coat hanger because I knew where he sat in the dressing room and I went for it and I'm afraid I nicked it. I've still got it. I don't know. Producer Joel, I don't know if this should go live or not because I might be sued by Arsenal.
Yeah, can we still call Philippe the moral compass of the pod? Now he's stolen a coat hanger. And now that there's form.
I will give it for charity. You know, this is redemption.
I also have to give Thierry Henry now because he's just got this thing about coat hangers. Everywhere he goes, someone nicks his coat hangers. He's furious. We should probably, Mark, talk a little bit about the football match. Yeah, Giroud is a one. I mean, you sort of feel like the target man. It sort of had a set of fallow years where you couldn't just be a slow centre forward, but now you can be again. And Giroud is sort of the ultimate because he scores a lot of goals as well.
Yeah, I think with Giroud, I mean, yes, he's slow, but what he offers the team in terms of being that physical presence up front, I think he's very much needed and appreciated by his teammates. And I do wonder, had Karim Benzema been up front, there would have been more star quality, but you do wonder how that front three of, you know, with Dembele and Mbappe and Benzema would have worked and whether it would have been as efficient. I think in terms of that, just the target man coming back, I do think it's easier to beat a press if you've got somebody up front that you can kind of aim for, you know, and you haven't got to play through the sort of midfield lines where it's very congested quite as much. So if you're Varane, for instance, and you don't want to go through Rabiot and then Griezmann to get to the front person, you could if you wanted to, and France don't necessarily do that, but you know, you are able to do that to you know, just hit the longer ball and just bypass the press. I also think that a lot of goals now are scored from out wide. I think it's one of the reasons why Kylian Mbappe wants to play out wide. There's a lot of space in that area. You see fullbacks getting a lot of the ball. You know, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Robertson done it best for Liverpool. And Teo Hernandez does it for Milan. Maybe not quite so much for France, but I still think he's very progressive in that position. So I think the role of everybody is kind of changing, you know, all the time. And now it does feel like that there's a lot of goals to be scored from those wider positions, and you therefore need somebody in the middle to just knit all of the play together. And I think you've got to be extraordinarily good to be small and be able to play as a false nine. Messi made it look easy when he did it for Barcelona, but it's not an easy position for anybody to play. And you know, there's a lot to be said for having that physical presence up front. You lose something because, you know, you haven't got the threat in behind, but if you've got the pace out wide, then, you know, you can almost suck the defence further up the pitch and then use those wingers to get in behind. But I want to get back to the coat hangers.
Yeah, Barry, I'm terrified that my first question for you in this part is Kylian Mbappe's good, isn't he? I mean,
I was expecting it.
I mean, those two goals are absolutely sensational, aren't they? Because the first one, I don't know about you, there's every part of me thinks he's putting it in the other corner.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I prefer the second one more for the way he received the ball. I remember, I think it was Phil Foden was saying how Pep Guardiola had taught him this trick of, you know, don't receive the pass on your leading foot, let it roll onto your behind foot, if you know what I mean. And that gave him the space to turn the defender and gave him the angle to shoot from. His first goal was brilliant as well. And I think Olivier Giroud played a big part in that, as has been discussed, you know, his takedown of the ball and then his run, which took out a couple of defenders and gave Mbappe the space. But I think we all kind of know that Olivier Giroud is only minding that record. He's a custodian, and it won't be long before someone else takes it off him.
It's not going to be as long as Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, is it? It's not going to be, you know, Giroud with the chainmail on going, Kylian, you have chosen wisely. Cholet says, everyone as touched as I was when Mbappe paid homage to Bruce Forsyth for his second goal celebration. I was sort of partially dealing with Ian Rushton, who'd taken a slight allergy to pecorino at the time of the second goal. So it's a middle-class baby So, but was it the hand to the head and the hand to the back? Was that the Mbappe celebration?
Yeah, well, I would argue it was Bruce Forsyth crossed with Ted Rogers because he gave it a bit of 3-2-1 right. Dusty bin as well, because it was his second goal, and obviously he made the assist as well. But something else. I mean, you didn't experience this, Max, but when we did that weird gig in, was it the science, London Science
yes.
Museum? Or,
yes.
And I got to wear the virtual reality headset, and it was programmed. So I was a hapless defender, and Kylian Mbappe was running at me with the ball in, you know, at full speed. It was terrifying. Like, it was truly terrifying.
Mm. I mean, I've never seen anyone look less coordinated on earth. It was really tremendous for anyone who was there. What did you make of Poland, Philippe? Because actually, like, leading up to this game, they'd been pretty abject. And, you know, they did have their moments. And as the first half wore on, they started growing in confidence, not unlike Australia yesterday. And, you know, Zielinski has this absolutely glorious chance. And I understand why he put his laces through it. And boy, did he put his laces through it. But anywhere else, and that is going in, right?
Yeah, and maybe I think they were encouraged by the fact that France is not one of those teams which will press very intensively, and therefore they let you breathe, and they certainly took advantage of that. It's funny that one of the great strengths of this French team should also be one of its weaknesses, which is the capacity to take things easy, I would say, to control things. And sometimes it gets a little bit excessive, and we see what happens with Poland. But did they give away a goal? No, they did not. And the only goal they gave was on that crazy penalty at the end. So, yeah, I was a little bit surprised. On the other hand, France is not a proactive team. And I was listening to Mauricio Pochettino, as you probably were, who was talking about the lack of passion for France and comparing it to other countries which have a lot of passion and energy in pressing in particular. The thing is that France has won the World Cup in 2018 without that passion. Deschamps is not a passionate man. That's not the way he makes his team play. And therefore, that's perhaps the recipe he's decided upon again, not to be passionate, not to press, and which explains why Poland certainly were far more positive in that game than they were before. But Max, one word though, Pecorino is two different things.
All right.
One of them you'll be forgiven because it's a cheese.
Yes.
But Pecorino is also a white wine.
Yeah, we didn't.
So which of the two was it?
It was Ian. We gave him some cheese. Apparently, it's a bit 9 months is too early to give Pecorino, which we found out on Google afterwards. What are you meant to do anyway? I mean, I suppose what you're saying is if there was a French way of saying laissez-faire, that's kind of what the French team are.
A little bit.
Mark, I'm getting lots of people ask Philippe about Rabiot, but we keep asking Philippe about Rabiot. I just wanted to go to someone else because I think he seems like a really brilliant footballer at the moment.
I wouldn't go for brilliant. I think he's I think he's doing a good job in central midfield, helped by Griezmann. We'll get on to Rabiot in a second, but I think the way that Griezmann has sacrificed himself for the team to make them, you know, there wouldn't be many, you know, forwards that have won the World Cup, played for Barcelona, Atletico Madrid in the highest profile matches that is willing to play that deep and work that hard for an international team. You know, he would be within his rights to say, well, I want to play in X position or Y position. But I think because he is dropping deep and adding that creativity that maybe Pogba would previously have done, that isn't allowing Rabiot to just, I suppose, play it quite safe and just not do anything silly in that position. He's working hard. I think he's dovetailing well with Tchouameni. They are protecting the defence enough. He's moving the ball forward adequately. I wouldn't say it's, you know, expertly or, you know, it's brilliant and outstanding, but he's definitely doing it well. And I think what the French team and what Deschamps is very good at, And what you need to be as an international manager is to just protect the kind of weaknesses in your team. And I think he does that really well, because there are still, I would say, issues in, say, central midfield and a right back. But because Koundé can't get forward so much, you know, it doesn't matter, because Dembélé has got the ability to kind of play that sort of really ultra-attacking position. And he's doing a steady job in central midfield. And I often wonder what he actually does really well. And that's been a question I've asked sort of people that, like Nikki, when she's watching Juventus, you know, what does he do really well? And nobody has ever really been able to explain to me what he's an expert at. But I think he's just all-round game for France has been steady and safe. And you couldn't always say that about him. I always feel like there's a mistake in him, but he hasn't done one yet.
Is he kind of a French Mason Mount, but with a more domineering mother?
I'd say he's less maybe hard-working than the Mount would be.
Maison Mount, says producer Joel.
Maison.
Mon maison, mon maison.
Philippe, you were on the radio with us earlier, and you said, and I think you were slightly worried about saying it, so I'm going to ask you to say it again. You reckoned that despite the fact he's a Ballon d'Or winner, that France are better off without Benzema.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you stand over now after seeing another 90 minutes of evidence?
Yes, I do. And obviously, if this is put in French somewhere, I'm going to get an awful lot of grief for it. Thank you very much, Barry. I really appreciate that.
Oh, the producers translate this into every language and dub us with actors. You played the role of yourself, Philippe. Surely you know this when you're up late. But anyway, carry on.
It's one of the debates. It's a fake debate. It's also a toxic debate in France between Benzema and Giroud. Benzema has said some less than complimentary things about Olivier Giroud, who has responded, I wouldn't say in kind, but his responses have been quite sharp to that. So there's this whole thing of the ambivalence between the two. And the fact is that if you look at the qualities of both players, who is the best number nine of the two? Karim Benzema. Nobody doubts that. Who fits in better in the system that Deschamps has put together, which is this 4-3-3, which is very much a kind of recreation from the Aimé Jacquet team of the 90s and Le Maire teams of the 2000s, who is the player who fits the best in the system? And the answer to that is Olivier Giroud.
I really enjoyed the Sunday League moment. And Robin Carroll on commentary said it was Sunday League. The Jules Koundé being told to take off his necklace, which is very much like, you know, the ref before the game going, I'll check your studs, any jewellery, which obviously changes from team to team. But in my, Barry, sort of very middle-class pecorino-eating team, you can imagine there just wasn't a whole lot of jewellery doing the rounds. But it was a really fun bit of just saying, take that off. Off you, come on, you know.
And Koundé says, I don't want to take it off. That old Claire fella will nick it.
Exactly. Anyway, that'll do for part two. If you want some live production debrief, producer Joel has written, this has been a really fun part. So well done to all of you. And we'll be back in a second with any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So tomorrow we've got Japan, Croatia and Brazil, South Korea. Tomiyasu looks set to start for Japan because Itakura is suspended. Croatia unlikely to make any changes, but they're young. You know, they can keep on running, can't they? Modric and Lovren on a yellow, so they'll miss the game if they're booked. I mean, obviously, Mark, I keep banging eyes. It's not like me to keep pushing a joke, but if they are tired, the Croatians, Japan's not who they want to play, is it?
It's not, no. And I found it very interesting. Gareth Southgate's not the most interesting sort of any press conferences usually, because he just plays it quite straight and, you know, that's probably the right way to go. But he mentioned in one that I watched earlier this week about within their preparation for the USA, they'd watched Japan and had realised, now maybe it's easy to say after the event, but they realised the sort of England sort of scouts that Japan were better than maybe most people thought going into the tournament, and they felt that they could cause Spain and or Germany some problems, and so it has proven. I think with Japan, they've definitely improved when they've made substitutions. I've not been quite sure what their team set up and the approach has been in the first half games, but they've definitely got better for the changes that they've made. I just always feel like, though, that Croatia are just a team that are not flaky. They're not going to make mistakes. They are.
No, they're wily bastards, aren't they?
They're so tough. They're so technically excellent. And I would edge towards Croatia. Japan have been energetic and got two amazing results to take down a couple of heavyweights. But I would still edge towards Croatia, I think.
Is there any way, Barry, South Korea can beat Brazil?
I don't think so. I think Brazil will be too good for them. I mean, it was weird. South Korea's game against, oh God, it was Friday. I can't remember.
Who Uruguay? No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Portugal.
I just found it slightly odd how little, they didn't seem that fussed by the fact that they were going out. And they weren't, you know, they have their system and they just stick to it. And they weren't, you know, hurling a big, some burly central defender up front and launching it to him. And it worked. I mean, it worked. They scored a remarkable goal to go through. I will be astonished if they beat Brazil, but I'm not going to say it won't happen. I think Japan will beat Croatia.
Juan could start for South Korea. Neymar might be in contention to start, which is mad considering the colour of his ankle. Gabriel Jesus apparently out for 3 months, Philippe. So that is a real impact for Arsenal's title challenge, isn't it? But look, we'll get to the Premier League in you know, Boxing Day or whatever it is. Now, a subject which I imagine if you don't like swearing, perhaps, or you listen with children, is just to be forewarned. David says, is there anything more disappointing than the FIFA-cation of Arsene Wenger? Then again, I suppose he did make somewhat of a habit of, quote, not seeing it. When asked about Germany's exit, he said at the World Cup technical study group briefing, you know, when you go to a World Cup, you know how you can't lose the first game. The teams who have the experience to perform in tournaments like France and England played well in the first game. The teams who were mentally ready with a mindset to focus on competition and not the political demonstrations. Philippe.
Yes, it's very disappointing. I'm not going to say it's totally surprising. I think Arsene has been somebody who has been dealing with very paradoxical positions for quite a while. He's been working with beIN Sports for a number of years, and you know, beIN Sports and Al Jazeera is Qatar. That's okay. We know he's been very close to PSG as well, which is also Qatar, and was offered a job there, which he refused, but remained very close to them. We know he spent a lot of time there. We also know that he took on the job of basically being in charge of football development there at FIFA. So it's still, I think it's more a moment of reckoning. It's more a moment that people realize that he's decided to put his credibility, his legacy with these people from FIFA, from Qatar, and especially from FIFA. And I'm not entirely surprised. So he's somebody who's got a very absolute view of the way football should be played. Because of that, I think he's able to dissociate himself with what is happening in the game at large. I'm not saying that is the right thing to do. I'm not saying that it is something that is necessarily excusable. I'm not saying I'm not disappointed. I think you can probably feel in my voice that I am.
Well, you know him really well, right? I mean, listeners may not know that.
Well, he's not a friend of me, but I've known Arsene for 30 years. So, yes, I know him well. And I'm not surprised that he said what he said. I will try to engage with him about it, by the way. But I find it absolutely typical of what is going on right now. It's also absurd because some of the teams which chose not to engage with the political side of it, for example, Belgium didn't do very well at all, whereas the team that probably engaged with the political side of this World Cup better than anybody else, i.e. the Australians, probably will, when the tournament is over, can look at it and think we are the team that overperformed the most of them all.
Less importantly, I'm starting to wonder whether, like, FIFA producers and directors have been explicitly told to get a cutaway of Gianni Infantino as soon as they possibly can. It's getting slightly ridiculous. Of course, the stadiums are close. He can be at every game. But, you know, I it is supposition. It may not be true. But nothing would talk about the ego of somebody who said, I need to be in shot more than being in shot for every game. And I hate it so much. Jax, has anyone else not enjoyed the weird countdown to the first whistle? A little too Super Bowl for me. Yeah, I don't know about you, Mark or Barry. That is just, we don't need 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, do we? We just, that, it's not, that isn't football and it's not progress, Mark.
Well, it's also not very practical because they're all ready to play, aren't they? I mean, like, they, we've got a countdown for, like, no reason. Usually, yeah, at least if it was like, I suppose you'd just done the photos and then you, you know, you getting the players to hurry up a little bit by going 10, 9, 8, 7, you know, we want to get this game off, then all well and good. But for some reason, we just have this shot of Griezmann or whoever it is just standing over a ball for 10 seconds while there's a really dry count down. I'm still missing the, you know, I don't think you could beat the Euros ones with the little car that...
Yeah, tiny car is absolutely fine.
I'm, you know, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's much more like it.
Louis says, what's the panel's thoughts on the Poland FC Copenhagen goalkeeper, Kamil Grabara, or Grabara, forgive me, tweets? Is this bloke the least professional footballer out there at the moment? So look, he is the number one keeper for Copenhagen. Matty Ryan is the number two. Kamil Grabara's out in Qatar as Poland's reserve keeper. Matty Ryan was signed for Copenhagen while Grabara was injured, dropped as soon as Grabara regained fitness. Ryan thought his demotion was due to club politics. Grabara said Ryan and he and Ryan are not friends. I just have to state that there is a reason why we're in ninth place in the Superliga and the goals have poured in. It speaks for itself. I don't see any competition for the goalkeeper position, he said, with reference to Matty Ryan. He tweeted, must have been politics for sure, winky emoji, after Matty Ryan's mistake yesterday. I mean, given that Matt Ryan had actually a really excellent World Cup as well, just seems so unbelievably uncalled for. Like, I mean, it's just like really like very strange. Like, you work with this person. Like, even you, like, there are lots of people don't like at work, but it's so public and just so unpleasant. Zosia, who is a listener to the pod, said, hello from Poland. He's widely known for being an arsehole. Before he got his late call up after Dragowski's injury, he said in an interview that maybe he should support a different white and red team. Perhaps he should learn the Danish anthem. Anyway, let's finish on an email from Jack. And we thank you, Jack, for getting in touch. We often get sent emails that are slightly emotional and or have meaning, and we're never really sure that the pod makes that much difference to people. But he says, hi, Max, Barry, and everyone. I've been a fan of the pod for a while now. I think I probably discovered it during Russia 2018. Spent quite a long time trying to track down the witch's curse debate, TM, he says. Yeah, other people have done that too. I lost my father a month ago as I write this. We didn't have the most straightforward relationship, but one thing we did share was the football. As a proud Irishman, the World Cup was generally a bit tense as he shared Barry's disdain for the England men's team. But like me, he couldn't help himself once the game started. The last month has been extremely difficult, not helped by moving house at the same time as processing my grief. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to contribute financially at the minute, but I wanted to reach out and thank you all sincerely for what I can only imagine is an absolute gargantuan effort to get these pods out every day. They've been a source of comfort and laughter through some very dark days. Thank you all. I'm sure you're all exhausted, but selfishly, I'm very glad you have had absolutely no time off. Gratefully yours, Jack. P.S. More Officer Crabtree match reports, please. Yeah, we'll see what we can do about that.
Well, obviously, our best wishes go to Jack, but I think, in the interest of, you know, it's sort of connected to our Herculean effort to get the pods out. So today's pod, parts 2 and 3, are recorded before the England game.
Yeah, they are.
So I'm cautiously optimistic we'll have a pod where part 1, Max is really, really sad, and Mark and then gets progressively more upbeat as the pod progresses.
You know, that's interesting because I actually had a chat with producer Joel saying, should we maybe not all do it all after the England game because it may change my mood? But also there's a really fun part of, look, we record in that way for sort of tedious admin reasons and so the producers can go to bed. But it's also the possibility, not only that I will be sad in part one, but it's also the possibility that you will be considerably more drunk in part one and then sober up through parts two and three. So look, both things to look forward to. We don't know what's happened to England yet, but look, fingers crossed they get through. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Yes, I'm waving goodbye with my uncrossed fingers, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.